I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today, the fashion show.
Do you have a shirt that you really love? One that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if it starts to fade. That only makes it nicer still. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. Do you have some jeans that you really love?
My guests today are designer Sid Mashburn.
Regardless of how you grew up, there usually is some respect for the order of things and heritage. And, you know, hey, what my, not necessarily what my dad wore, but what my grandfather wear, you know, that hasn't really changed that much. I mean, it has some, but there's still, don't you think there's that sense of passing things along?
Writer and founder of Paper Cut Project, Amy Fleury.
Why paper wigs? Why paper anything, for that matter, that goes to this length and extent? And these things can take sometimes 40 to 80 hours to make one. Why would you do that for any other reason other than this, you know, driven by this idea of art?
Victorian dress expert Cynthia Crowder.
And I'm a history buff extraordinaire, specializing in the history of costume, history of clothing, as a means of understanding a lot of how that affects who we are, who we were, as the case may be, and especially for women. It's been a defining point for us throughout history of how clothes restrict movement, how clothes enable movement, how all of that impacts their daily lives.
And the owner of Friedman's Shoes, Bruce Teilhaber.
I might buy only red if that's all they had, only purple. Very rarely was it black. So, I mean, you had to be able to sell, and you had to be able to work your product. Later on, when we started making our own shoes in our own sizes, it was really easy because we had everything.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today, the fashion show, brought to you by Perkins & Will.
They seek him here. They seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion.
In a city as diverse as Atlanta, it would be impossible to identify a unified style. But if one person and one store could be said to represent the classic and timeless Southern sensibility, it would be Sid Mashburn.
I grew up loving clothes. I mean, strangely, like when I was 9 years old, I was into clothes. My sisters were much older than me, and they always kind of, I was kind of like their dress-up doll in a way. I was their younger brother, and we had another brother, and he passed away, but he was a very, very sharp dresser. And he always reminded me of either sort of the guys from I Spy and Get Smart and Dick Van Dyke. Their clothes were kind of slim, and you know, they were cool and not really geeky, but I had a little bit of a conservatism, but also it kind of cut against the grain too. I just loved it. I thought it was cool. I was like, those guys look cool. And I wanted to look like that. So combining that love of people and the love of clothes, it just, you know, kind of grew into, wow, that could be a vocation. And I started working at this. I loved clothes. So as soon as I got my driver's license, I was like, I'm getting a job at a clothing store where if I can make some money, you know, to feed my desire to get clothes in that environment, that's perfect for me. And the store I worked in is was one of the best men's clothing stores, at least at that time.
It's what
called,
was that?
In Jackson, it was called The Rogue. Back then, that store, you know, appealed to guys all over the South. And they had better goods, and they had entry price point goods, and the guys that worked in there, you know, one guy knew a lot about cars, one guy knew a lot about music, another one knew a lot about travel, another guy knew about literature. As a matter of fact, was a English professor, you know, during the school year, And so you walked in. It was like you were just entertained by these guys and kind of the various interests. It wasn't like you were going to get clothes.
What was the style?
Kind of classic. I hate to say preppy because that can be such a pejorative term, but it's pretty classic. You know, it's tweed jackets, corduroy pants, jeans, Clark's desert boots. A little bit of a reflection of the times. You know, the lapels were the width that they were in the 70s, and you know, everybody's hair was a little bit longer, and it just when you walked in there, it was like, man, there's something going on here. And when you walked in, they made you feel like it just was. How do we make these guys feel comfortable? And so, that's probably some seeds.
Well, let's take kind of a moment to focus on this, which is, I mean, what's the foundation for looking great?
I think it's a little bit of pride in how you appear, you know. And I think that there's you could almost lapse into saying there's a social contract that feels like it needs to be satisfied. But I think it kind of goes, for the guys who really like to dress, it goes beyond that. It's like, I like to dress, I like to express myself this way, I'm going to wear this. And what's cool about it is the guys that are well-dressed here, to me, can easily make the transition to New York or easily make the transition to Italy without needing a wardrobe change. And that, to me, is the hallmark of a well-dressed guy, is a guy who doesn't look different every time you see him. As a Southern guy, boy, I've tried a lot of styles that really didn't last very long. But I found my way to my style, and I have dialed it back over the years because I feel like I'm getting older, and I feel like in some ways it's a little bit of a younger guy's game. Now, that doesn't mean I still don't have a pair of paisley pants and some sandals and some beads I'll wear, you know, because I do, because, you know, I want to hold on to that, because in a way it just, there's a feeling I get when I put that on.
A question back to this kind of notion of place and fashion. Do you see the people of a city almost, and what they wear, almost as an accessory to the city?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, not too long ago, probably back in the spring, GQ shot out something online that said the 20 worst dressed cities in America. It was like cities couldn't respond quick enough. It was like, yeah. And I think Atlanta was ranked pretty high up there, and the local, one of the local TV stations called me to come comment on it. And, you know, we have some friends that work at GQ, and in the back of my mind, I'm kind of wondering, did y'all just want a story, or did you really think that these were the worst-dressed cities? Because really, you could say every city's got its best-dressed and worst-dressed. But I would say that, you know, when you go to New York, you expect to see fashion, and you expect to see a typical genre of fashion. I mean, when you think New York, you think black. Everybody up there is probably wearing black clothes. You know, when you think of Atlanta, you think of people wearing bright clothes. And so I think that in some ways, when people come to a city, you know, from somewhere else, they can get a particular impression. I mean, you go to Italy, you expect to see well-dressed people. And in a sense, you start, I think that when you see that, you immediately go, oh, this is a stylish city. So it doesn't just stop at what they're wearing. It sort of extends to the cars, to the restaurants, to everything around you, because whether we want to admit it or not, people are making a pretty fast impression on what they think of you. And oftentimes it's by what you're wearing. So it kind of behooves any city, or at least the people that run the city, to say, you know what, we need to set an example. You know, and an example of setting an example is when we see so many people going to the bar beside us at JCT. And a lot of times the girls will look like $1 million. They're in dress and nice shoes, and guys are wearing cargo shorts and T-shirt. They're letting their end of the bargain down, you know, in a way. And it's like it doesn't reflect well, you know, on him, I don't think. Where she's trying, he's not trying. And so I think that in some ways that extends also to a city. You can see a city that really kind of prides itself, whether it's in the sidewalks or the buildings, the way the place is landscaped, just the general care taken of the city. It kind of goes back to that broken window theory, you know? You know, you feel good when your surroundings are good.
I was shopping for a suit the other day and walked into the department store. Stepped on the elevator and told the girl, dry goods flow. When I got off of Sam was coming up to me, he said, now what can I do for you? I said, well, go in there and show me all the sport clothes, like you supposed to. He said, well, sure, come on in, buddy, dig these fabrics we got laid out on the shelf. He said,
pick yourself out one, try it on, stand in the mirror and dig yourself. Ooh, that suit's pure herringbone.
Yeah, that's the suit I'd like to own.
Ooh, buddy, that suit is you.
For the businessman, you featuring the natural shoulders that retail, wholesale, and deal. It's got the custom cuffs and the walking chalk, he said.
And I'm gonna let you have it a steal.
And for the playboy, you have the latest in tweed with the cutaway flap over twice. It's a box back two button western model, he said.
Nah, ain't that nice? Ooh, them buttons are solid gold.
Fashion is not just something we wear, it's something we analyze and appreciate as art. And perhaps nobody's work in Atlanta better represents this hybrid status as Amy Fleury and her company, The Paper Cut Project.
And we create these kind of fantastical styling elements in paper for high-end, high-end fashion productions like runway or windows or museums.
For someone who hasn't seen Paper Cut Project or the beautiful pieces that you create, can you paint the picture
can
for them?
Can I try with words to what I should kind of preface this with is that these paper pieces are very sculptural in nature. We're best known for our paper wigs that have gone atop models or mannequins. I think we solved a problem in that when you see mannequins in a window, you can dress them in couture, but unless you put something on that head, they're kind of unfinished. And trying to get something atop that head to make it look beautiful and to elevate the experience of that rather than make it look really goofy is difficult.
Explain, you know, like what it looks like. I'm looking at the
picture. I didn't paint that picture, did I?
No, but we're going to.
Okay.
And then I want to come back to the windows. But like I'm looking at this and I definitely see like these beautiful pieces of art, but I also see hair. And,
oh, yeah.
But it's made out of paper.
Because every client that we attract, everyone that has commissioned this has a vague idea of what they want, but they want our interpretation in paper. So we will be approached by Kate Spade, for example, who is doing a Lillian Bassman homage to this photographer and her work, and they wanted hair that looked like it was windswept, as if a fan was blowing all hair in one direction, and that's how they wanted the windows to appear. And I think in the windows they probably did have a fan circulating to blow, so the hair had to always look like it was going in that direction. Whereas Cartier said we want architectural hair because of an event they were giving. And I mean, some of these wigs are probably 2-3 feet tall, and they are structural. They are engineered from the inside out. They're very people cannot quite understand how they're made, truthfully. But here's another picture where this is an afro and in paper, and every one of these curls are hand cut with an X-Acto knife, and they're a different spiral or they're a different curl, so it creates just this depth. And I think by using their monotone, so most of our wigs are white, and when you have white, it creates this shadow effect, and so it creates a real depth to these pieces. And that's what I think makes it artful. We've seen Jackson Fine Art, in fact, underwrote a whole collection that we did for Italian Vogue, and this went in their December issue. And they were very 60s inspired, but these things ended up being so sculptural that people, in fact, bought them as sculpture and have them in their windows lit. People tell us there's someone in Ainslie Park that has one that they drive by every night. So they really have a different appeal to a broader group of people than probably we had in mind when we first came up with this idea.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today, The Fashion Show, brought to you by Perkins & Will. Though we all strive to look our best, we don't generally think about fashion as competition. But on some occasions, it definitely is. And on those occasions, you need a judge.
My name is Cynthia Holloway Crowder, and I am the lead judge for the Sunday in the Park Victorian Costume Contest, an homage to the old tradition, and it was an old tradition, of viewing a Sunday trip to the cemetery as a family event. You would gather all the children, get in the carriage or the wagon, and go to the cemetery for a picnic, believe it or not. And I guess you could view it as going to have dinner with grandma, in a sense. It was because they were, and to take care of the plot. They would go and, you know, do a little, like, gardening, and because Sunday was a day of rest, and you spent that time with the family.
How did you become the judge of a costume contest?
It's interesting because I actually started attending that event, I think, in its infancy, more or less. It had been occurring for a little while, but it started out as a Victorian hat contest. And that was, I want to say, in the mid-90s, 95, 96, thereabouts. And then people just sort of naturally started putting the costumes together with the hats, which was around the time when I joined and
so
started
the accessory
coming.
Kind of led.
Exactly. The hat led. And then we started with the group. And ladies, some of the gorgeous hats they would come with. And it led from there. And then my involvement came. I had a friend who was actually involved with helping with the judging, and she snagged on to my interest in costuming and the fact that I had done a lot of costuming at that point and had worn some of my outfits to Oakland and asked if I would assist. And there's actually two different, say, disciplines of costuming. One is the people who, like ourselves, who do a variety of costuming. I specialize in Victorian and Edwardian, okay? But we also have people who specialize in fantasy costuming, science fiction costuming. Steampunk has now become a very popular one. If you've seen, in fact, in the last couple of years at Oakland, we've seen steampunk almost take over to an extent.
And that's kind of like a steampunk's like a Victorian meets like a time traveler, right?
It is. It's Jules Verne is basically what it is. And it's funny because I actually, one of my early costumes that I competed at the World Science Fiction Convention, believe it or not, was called 1901, A Space Odyssey. Shycon 91, 92, which I didn't realize later was steampunk. It was steampunk before it was steampunk.
You're the head judge at Sunday in the Park, mm-hmm, in a Victorian, mm-hmm, era costume contest at Oakland Cemetery. How do you judge the costume? Who wins? What do you need to do?
We're looking at several different aspects of the costume because we have actually several different categories. One is we look at authenticity. In other words, how authentic is it? We look at workmanship. In other words, what effort did you put into this outfit? Even to the point of checking your undergarments. Your foundation garments, to see how realistic it is. Other aspect is beauty. How, you know, just looking at the costume, how beautiful does it pull together? Does the hat match the dress? Is it just nicely done? And imagination, the level of imagination that goes into it. I know one of the costumes that sticks in my head that really, really, truly impressed us was a gentleman who, physically challenged. He had basically was working on the spring legs, the I think the cheetah blade type accents, and he had done them as steampunk. So he had decorated them and colored them in brass and had this magnificent top hat with the goggles and the whole aviator style. But he had taken all of these parts of his different prosthetics and made them into steampunk and put the gears on them and made them look just incredible.
You did actually such a nice job at describing that. Would you describe what maybe one of the winners was like for a woman and one of these dresses?
One actually, believe it or not, one of our winners, this I think it was the year before last, actually, was a strawberry shortcake bustle dress, which I know sounds rather odd, but she called herself Strawberry Shortcake Victorian, but it was an adaptation of a strawberry theme into a dress, which surprisingly, as much as we think about Victorians being sort of, you know, black and white, you know, they were not. Aniline dyes had just been discovered in the Victorian period, and they went crazy with them. Clothing was actually quite bright. One of the best movies I've seen for pointing that out, believe it or not, was Meet Me in St. Louis with Judy Garland, the clothing, people kind of pull back because she was wearing like green and yellow, like bright green and yellow. And I'm like, that was period. They were in love with these aniline dyes. And so the clothing was actually quite bright. And so that she had taken that and adapted it into this full bustle gown with like different shades of green and red. And with all of the different, she had the hair, the bright red hair with the big fat sausage curls, and this just adorable little hat with strawberries. And at first you think it would be comical, but it wasn't. It worked. It worked as a whole. And so we gave her best in show. I mean, it was a really magnificent little outfit, and it showed a lot of imagination and adaptation.
Not just winsome, not just wise, not just easy on the eyes, not just someone who will do, but a raving beauty are you. Not just gentle, not just kind, not just dainty and refined, not exotic or bizarre, but a raving beauty you are. You're not at all just someone I'd call attractive. You're more the kind I'd only find in a dream. Not just modest and demure, overwhelming is what you're stupendous, you're supreme. Though you're unattainable, it's explainable why you're my kind of cutie. You're a raving, a tearing beauty.
Harkening back to the much more modern past, we're going to conclude today with one of Atlanta's longest-standing fashion institutions. Since 1929, that institution has been Freedman's Shoes. And joining us are owners Bruce and Brett Talhaber.
Yeah, Freedman's Shoes started as a shoe shop. My father-in-law repaired shoes and sold worn shoes. We used to buy shoes by the pound, believe it or not. And we had he had the contact where he got all Florsheim shoes returns. Anything that was returned, damaged or didn't fit, whatever the customer didn't want, we would buy it, repair it, and sell it. And a little bit down the road, 58 years ago, he let me buy a few pair of damaged new shoes. We had the shoe shop there, so we fixed the shoes and then sold them. But it was so crazy in those days, because you'd have 100 pair, 200 pair of shoes, and people would come in with a 9, and you had to be able to sell them a 10. Or if someone had a narrow foot, you had to be able to pad it, because you didn't have the sizes. And my sons and I, we know our customer. We've always bought for our customer. In today's world, we cater to the big feet. We sell more size 14s to 18s than any store in the world. I'm sure of that. And we buy for our customer. We know what you like. And we've been doing it for so long, my four sons can look at your feet and have you within two pair. They'll know exactly what you like. And we have the ammunition to do it.
How was it, Brett, growing up in as a kid? Were you working in the store then, or did you get into it a little bit later?
No, ever since I could walk or talk, I've been coming down. I guess 1972, I was about 7 years old, and that's when I would go around handing shoehorns, you know, a little metal piece you use to put on your shoes to people. And by the time I was 10 years old, I was selling shoes on the floor.
You've got some experience.
I got a few years behind me. I'm 47 now, so I've seen every superstar you can imagine to just your normal guy coming in to buy a pair of wingtips.
Well, let's take, I guess, a step back, pardon the pun, to when you started changing business and this new customer was coming in.
I'll tell you exactly who it started with. It was a Boston basketball player named Tom Heinsohn, who I loved. And he came in the store, and he wore a 15B. I'll never forget it. And I had no shoes for him. And it broke my heart. And I said to myself, Bruce, never again will you not have shoes. And I went and I found this company. It was called Ambassador Shoe Company, who made shoes. They made shoes in Italy, in fact. And they made me size 13s to 15s in narrows, mediums, and wides. And I thought I was absolutely crazy. And I probably was. But the Lord takes care of dummies and drunks. And he sure took care of me because we did nothing but sell them. And the first sport team that came in was the San Francisco Giants. And some of those guys had friends on the 49ers. And in those years, the 49ers and the Rams used to come in every year. And they told their friends about us, the big guys. And they started coming in. And I guess for 30 years, the best day we had was the day San Francisco came in and New Orleans came in. Because we used to get them by the busloads. It was absolutely fun, wonderful, and you see a guy that wears a 16 or 17, and he'd never saw shoes to fit him before, and we'd come out with each shoe in six colors. It was like big kids in candy stores.
Bruce, what's the largest shoe you ever sold?
22.
Yeah, is that about as big as we as human beings get?
No. The Hawks drafted this guy named Gonzalez from Argentina, 7'7", 525 pounds. They brought him here as a basketball player, and he wore a 24, 26. And I was able, we got him a pair of shoes. I don't remember who he had them made from, but he got the shoes, and when he put them on, he kissed the shoes. Well, it wound up that he couldn't play basketball. His feet were too slow. So Turner made a wrestler out of him. If I remember correctly, his name was
Elegante.
Elegante. And he stayed here for years. A nice guy, always came in the store. But he was a big, big guy, 7'7". Manute Bol was 7'7" and wore a 17. So look at the difference. And when Shaquille holds a 22 in his hand, it looks like a shoe. Dikembe Mutombo also wears a 22. He holds it in his hand, it looks big. It's just how broad Shaq is. So I mean, all these guys are different. It's but big is big. Big is big.
So I've got big shoes to fill, and I'll do the best I can. I just hope my best is good enough for you. Yes, I've got big shoes to fill, and I hear he wore them well. But don't forget, he used these shoes to walk right out on you.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Sid Mashburn, Amy Fleury, Cynthia Crowder, and Bruce Teilhaber, along with his son Brett. I'd like to give a special thanks to Deanna Lucas for all of her help in putting the show together. Of course, as always, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. Sidewalk Radio can be enjoyed anytime from anywhere by visiting us on iTunes. While you're there, please make sure to rate and review us. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. See you next month.